Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. We're hearing a lot about improving Albuquerque's economy. Make Albuquerque an innovation hub. Upgrade the zoo biopark. Spend millions on bus rapid transit. What if I told you that one of the easiest ways to increase economic activity is to simply slow down traffic in our downtown? That recommendation is part of a report to the city on downtown walkability by Jeff Speck, a city planner who's redesigned many, many downtowns and who is the author of the book, Walkable Cities. Jeff Speck, welcome to the program.
Hey, Stephen, thank you for having me.
Jeff, later in the show, I really want to concentrate on your specific recommendations and your rationale for them. But let's start with how and why slowing down traffic could possibly increase economic activity.
And what I found in your downtown, as I find in many American downtowns, but certainly even more so in the Western ones, where kind of, you know, there's this cowboy mentality around moving cars like they used to want to move horses, that the speeds that you're witnessing on downtown streets are speeds that make pedestrians feel uncomfortable.
So is that the key to the point that I was trying to make to begin with in the introduction, that because pedestrians aren't comfortable, we need with the rate of speed, the rate of traffic, we need to slow traffic down so pedestrians will be comfortable. And the idea is if they're more comfortable, there'll be more pedestrians, they'll do more shopping, they'll do more walking, and the downtown will be more vibrant.
We're not talking about really lengthening anyone's commute or making it very much harder or even noticeably harder to get through downtown quickly. What we're really talking about are all those little cues in the street network that cause people to actively speed, i.e. break the speed limit. Because, in fact, if people drove the speeds that were marked on most of your downtown streets, we wouldn't have a problem. But most of the downtown streets in Albuquerque are actually engineered for considerably higher speeds than they're posted at. You know, many of them, actually, the rules in the development process manual, which is what people who work on the design and construction of those streets have to follow, say that they have to be engineered for 50 miles an hour or more. So obviously you have this environment which is encouraging illegal behavior in people's driving.
So one of the things I found really interesting in your report was that there's a current demand for walkable cities, and the future looks incredibly bright for walkable cities. You have this data that suggests that, for example, the number of 19-year-olds who declined driver's licenses in the 70s was, I think, 1 out of 12, whereas now the number is 1 out of 4. Mm-hmm. You similarly say that that out of the next 100 million households that are going to be created between now and 2025, that 88 million of those will be childless, so that, you know, you're no longer interested, particularly in a suburban lifestyle or in a big backyard. So
there's now more families in America with dogs than with children.
Really? And that's going to grow, apparently.
So the main pressures that would cause people to leave the city aren't there. And in fact, if you talk to millennials, you know, who grew up on Friends and Seinfeld and Sex and the City, their image of the good life for so many of them is urban living. You know, when you poll them, you find they're much less interested in having a car than they are in having, you know, good connection on their smartphone and their other devices. And these are the folks who are driving the new urban pioneering you see with all these folks moving back into the city. But the other group, which is even larger actually, is their parents, which are the front-end boomers who are, you know, relocating in record numbers starting a few years ago and ending many, many years from now. And they are looking for that last home they're going to have. They're looking to leave behind the big suburban house that they have to spend a lot of money cooling and heating and cleaning. And some of them are thinking about this, and I'd be remiss if I were to say that they're all thinking about it, but many of them are thinking, you know, what's going to happen when I can't drive anymore? And do I want to have to immediately lose my autonomy you know, become a second-class citizen, become a non-viable American, and have to get warehoused in some sort of institution because I can no longer fulfill my own needs on foot. And the fact is, you can walk. If you're in a walkable neighborhood where you have daily access to stuff that you need, you can walk safely for much longer than you can drive. And in fact, that walking is one of the things that keeps you vital and living longer. So, you know, the question isn't whether a lot of Americans are going to be doing this, particularly the millennials. The question is, are they going to do it in your city? Or are they going to do it in some other city which can provide them that lifestyle which they imagine, you know, is the dream of urban living?
So it's how do we make Albuquerque a more walkable city?
Yeah.
But why don't you describe your general theory of walkability?
Well, it's not all that counterintuitive, but some of the recommendations that it leads to can be surprising. But what it essentially says is to acknowledge that it's very hard to get people to walk in America. You know, in America, where most of us do own cars and the car is sitting in the driveway between us and everything else, and it's so cheap to drive, you know, but not by a long shot do we pay the full cost of driving. Making the choice to drive the car, it's a smart thing to do, to drive it all the time. Given those circumstances, if we're going to get Americans to make the choice to walk, then the walk has to be as good as the drive or better. And what does that mean? And essentially, you can boil it down to four categories. The walk has to be useful. You have to really get stuff done by walking. The walk has to be safe, which means you essentially, it used to be about crime, and now it's not. Now it's about your true safety, which is a function of whether or not you're going to be hit by a car, principally. It has to be comfortable, which has to do with that's the most subtle discussion, but has to do with the shaping of spaces and understanding that no one likes to walk on a street without good edges. We like to feel contained, like our streets should be like outdoor living rooms, you know, with walls, and those walls are the fronts of buildings. And that's why many streets, particularly in downtown Albuquerque, aren't accommodating to pedestrians because they've got a big surface parking lot up against the side of the street, and you kind of lose the desire to walk in that area because you're no longer comfortable. And then finally, the fourth category is the walk has to be interesting. Because we bore so easily, you know, it only takes like one insurance sales office or post office or something on a retail street to just cause us to turn around and go back to our car. So it's important, you know, simple rules like no blank walls, taking parking structures that are right up against the sidewalk and doing something else with that edge. Ideally, if you're going to build a new parking structure, you set it back from the sidewalk and put some residential or something in between the sidewalk and that building to hide it. And then, of course, organizing your retail and your other uses so that the activities are continuous and you're not interrupting retail with boring stuff like offices as you're walking down a street that's supposed to be a shopping street.
So let me mention, if you just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone Jeff Speck. Jeff was contracted to prepare and did prepare a walkability analysis for the city of Albuquerque, and we're talking to him about the general theory of his walkability analysis, and I really want to get into sort of the guts of it. Why don't you describe your downtown?
You know, in Albuquerque's development process manual, the standard lane width is 12 feet. Well, guess what? A 12-foot lane is a 70-mile-an-hour lane. So the first step is to make the lanes a width that corresponds to the speed you want to see, which in most downtown streets is the old standard of a 10-foot lane. So suddenly, in a four-lane street, you've got an extra 8 feet of asphalt to work with that you can do stuff with. Another interesting thing, three-lane streets, you know, streets which have a center turn lane that's continuous, have been shown to handle as much traffic as four-lane streets.
Yeah, so that's really counterintuitive.
Any street which is a four-laner, you can immediately turn into a three-laner. And that's because of the great inefficiency of the four-lane street, where the fast lane is also the turning lane, right? It's also very dangerous because the fast lane is also the turning lane. And we've seen all over the U.S. that when you turn four-laners into three-laners, injuries and deaths drop dramatically, and yet the traffic volume does not drop at all. So there's a lot of little tricks like that to find additional asphalt in the street that can be put to other use. Then the question is, what is the best other use for that asphalt? It tends to be one of two.
Before you go there, I just wanted to emphasize something in your report, which I think we all sort of recognize, but we don't necessarily follow, and that is, you know, the faster the traffic, the more crashes there are, and the more deadly those crashes are. And there's a real formula.
35, you're 8 times as likely to die than if you're hit by a car going 25. So that 30-mile-an-hour threshold is really important. And most of the changes we're talking about, for example, from a 12-foot lane to a 10-foot lane, are the sort of thing that get people to drive closer to, you know, closer to under 30 than to over 30. But basically, when you find these streets that have extra asphalt that are being put to, you know, that are being put to only one use, which is to encourage speeding, then typically you can do one of two things with it. One is to provide bicycle facilities, which is something that people are demanding in cities, that there's a great interest in having more of in Albuquerque, that millennials say very much they want to see in the cities that they're going to move to.
We got wonderful bike paths around the city, but not really into the city.
You've got a tremendous regional system, and particularly a recreational system, but I'm talking about a active transportation system. You know, what we're seeing in many American cities is people commuting on bike.
I'm a cyclist. I'm petrified too, and I cycle like all the time, 3 or 4 days a week. But I mean, I would never cycle into Albuquerque. The traffic is just moving too fast.
Well, people do.
Yeah, I know.
And they get hurt, some of them. But one thing, one great use for extra asphalt is bike lanes. The other, and this may sound strange for a pro walkability guy, but it's essential to the health of downtown. The other is parallel parking. So parallel parking should be on just about every curb in your downtown. It's essential for businesses. It's really key to business success. But from a strictly safety point of view, it's a barrier of steel that protects the sidewalk from moving vehicles. So if you have that, and think about your experience on a sidewalk, when you have that, you know, 7 feet of cars between you and the moving traffic, it's what makes you safe. So,
and you perceive it that way too, right? When you're walking along, there's a barrier
to you that might pull out or pull in.
Yeah.
Slows you down a bit. And frankly, the fact that you might find a parking space slows you down a bit.
Right.
So, it's all in support of a more walkable, but also a more vital business.
So, Jeff, let me ask you this. So what do you, first, there must have been some reason why the streets were designed this way to begin with. So what do you lose? Cut down the lanes and narrow the widths of the lanes in the downtown area. Surely you must lose something.
Well, that's one of my favorite discussions. The one thing you can potentially lose on narrower streets, for example, residential streets, when you're changing from two 12-foot lanes to a single 12-foot lane handling two directions of traffic, that's an extreme example and not really applicable in your downtown. But then fire access becomes an issue. And one, certainly in residential neighborhoods, one of the key forces towards the widening of streets has been getting fire trucks quickly to and from incidents. And I say incidents and not fires, because most of what the fire trucks are sent out for are actually car crashes. And we always look at the statistics and see how much more likely a car is to crash on a wider street and how many more people are injured, and particularly pedestrians are injured and killed on wider streets. And we joke that the fire department's wide streets, you know, which they demand, are actually very effective at moving their trucks quickly to the accidents that they cause. But there's a real interesting conversation to be had in residential communities about this real question as to whether wider streets are making neighborhoods more safe because fire trucks can get into them easily, or more dangerous because the pedestrians are dropping like flies as the cars speed. But the real issue in the downtown, much more, it's a little more of a sophisticated conversation. Your listeners will bear with me because it's actually quite fascinating, that the profession of traffic engineering is founded on a huge misunderstanding. And it's a misunderstanding that makes sense for highways, but absolutely makes no sense when applied to walkable downtown areas. You have to remember that the transportation safety profession grew out of highway design. that it arose to make highways more safe, and only later was it applied without consideration to non-highway environments. And what it tells us is that because drivers are going to go whatever speed they're going to go, because, you know, when you get on the highway, you see the speed limit says 65, and so you set your cruise control for 75, that because your speed is independent of your environment, that the fewer obstacles, the fewer potentials for accidents that you have in the environment, the safer it is. What does that mean? You know, if you're going to go 65 on the highway or 75, no matter what the design is, then wider lanes are safer because you're less likely to hit the cars next to you. Fewer trees are safer because, you know, there's no trees to hit. Having divided highways so no one's coming at you is safer. Having no parallel parking is safer. You know, having no bikes is safer. And that makes sense on highways. But the problem is that that same thought process has been applied to downtown. And what the engineers didn't think about was that when you're driving in a downtown area or any kind of urban or, you know, suburban area where there's people and houses and stuff around, it's not the speed limit that sets your speed. It's your perceptions of the environment. And it's precisely your perceptions of the potential for conflict. So if your strategy is to remove potential for conflict by widening lanes, by removing parallel parking, by eliminating trees, which many cities still do, then all you're doing is removing those things that cause drivers to drive more safely. So it's an incredible mistake that has, you know, won the day in traffic engineering for about 40 years. Starting about 20 years ago, traffic engineers began to publicly question this. And now if you go to any truly, you know, best practices traffic engineering firm in the country, they will tell you what I'm telling you, which is that it was a mistake and we need to change our standards so that the cues in the environment are telling drivers not to speed. Yet, even though we've figured this out and the leading lights of the industry will all agree upon it, you get to a city like Albuquerque, and frankly, most American cities, I'm not just pointing my finger at you, and you've got something in place like your, you know, development process manual that is mandating the stupid mistake that we figured out years ago was wrong.
Well, let me just mention, if you just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. I'm very pleased to have on the phone Jeff Speck, who prepared a walkability report for the city. And the walkability report basically suggests it does it sort of as efficiently and cheaply as possible, essentially restriping all these streets that Jeff's just been talking about to eliminate some of the lanes, narrow pretty much all the lanes. And the idea then is that traffic and to lower the speed limits, and that will slow down traffic. But I'm count me as a skeptic as to in terms of what the economic effect will be, and that's really what I want to talk to you, because that's sort of one of the points is if we slow down traffic, we're going to increase pedestrians, we're going to increase growth, we're going to get corporations to move here, we're going to get entrepreneurs to move here. But when, you know, when I walk around the downtown, I see the other factors that you mentioned in your general walkability theory, which is there's a 30 to 35% vacancy rate. There's a lot of ground level asphalt parking. There's huge parking lots. There's a lot of boring, uninteresting buildings. There are a lot of setbacks. So I'm just wondering if just restriping is going to do it. And it seems to me, you suggest in your report it won't, that you need to do something you call urban triage, which is really concentrate on the most walkable parts of the city and try to increase the other aspects of what makes a city walkable in those areas.
Yeah, I mean, my study focuses principally on the safety of the streets because that's the easiest thing to fix quickly. But as you've noted, the study actually deals with all four categories of the safe, useful, comfortable, and interesting walk, and has some very specific recommendations about lots of other things that can be done, but I would say that none of it will make that much of a difference if the streets don't feel safer. And because my client was the city, and frankly, even in cities where my client isn't the city, my client might be a downtown development agency or some, or a, you know, chamber of commerce or something. Still, the majority of the recommendations are directed at the city because the city owns the streets, and the city has the opportunity then to quickly, cheaply, and very impactfully make them safer. Now, is that going to make the downtown thrive? I would say it's necessary but not sufficient and important to making the downtown thrive. But there's a bunch of other things that need to be done as well.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned, and I think this is, you know, I guess I want to put this to you directly, is that, you know, our housing to office worker, our housing resident to office working worker ratio is sort of off. It's like 5-1. There's five, I think, workers for every resident. And it seems to me that maybe the city's been concentrating on the wrong thing. Rather than trying to big in businesses and entrepreneurs, there's nothing wrong with that. But maybe what we really need to do is concentrate on market rate housing and actually try to develop more housing in the central city. That necessarily is going to lead to more people in the central city.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny if you think about a typical residential subdivision with single family houses and low density, you might say 4 units per acre. If you go over your downtown area, which was my assignment for this study, you know, the busiest parts of the downtown where there's this greatest perception of urbanism and density, I believe it's 2 units per acre of housing through your downtown core.
That's so really a total suburban percentage. Yeah.
Your ratio of workplace to housing is about 5-1. Your dream ratio is about 1-1. I've seen much worse. You know, downtown Boise, which is a pretty nice downtown, but they roll up the sidewalks at night because the ratio there is, I believe, 43-1. So it could be tougher,
wow.
But certainly what many American cities are finding is the best and quickest way to increase the success of the downtown is to do everything at the city government's disposal to encourage developers to build attainable housing in the downtown in large numbers. And what we're finding in city after city, including some cities where you wouldn't really think people want to live, like, you know, Davenport, Iowa, you know, typically small, not that exciting downtowns, forgive me, Davenport, that they just can't build it fast enough. You know, you build a building with 50 units and they fill up, and then you build another building and it fills up. And the challenge, though, is to do it attainably, because there's a lot of things that add to the cost of building downtown, a lot of reasons why it's more expensive to build downtown than it is to build in a suburban subdivision. And if the city wants to have the success that comes from having a vital downtown and wants to invest in that success, it actually makes sense to find ways to invest in developers building housing in your downtown. You know, even if it means using tax increment financing or some other tool to make it less expensive for the developers to do their business.
Jeff, we're nearing the end of the show, and you know, there's some positive developments that are going on in the downtown area. There's a grocery store coming in. There's Innovate Albuquerque coming in at Broadway and Central. CNM is going to be having a lot of students at the Galleria Mall.
Yep.
So I'd like to get your sort of thought about where you think Albuquerque's heading. And there are these positive developments. Let's say there's $900,000 in the current bond issue to restripe the streets, as you suggest. Where do you think Albuquerque's heading in, say, the near term, the next 5 years?
Well, let me say, first of all, because I want your listeners to know this, that my whole walkability study is online. You can just Google, I believe, Jeff Speck Walkability Study Albuquerque, and it comes up. You can also find my entire, I believe, 2-hour presentation of my study to a large audience online as a video. It's on YouTube, and I think it's called Towards a More Walkable Albuquerque. But I'm pretty optimistic about Albuquerque. I think Albuquerque is a bit behind, frankly, many American cities of similar size. But it has a good brand. I don't know if you people who are from out of town know this, but it's thought of as a pretty hip place. There's the whole Route 66 thing. It's considered quite an authentic city. You know, people are kind of tired of places that all look like each other, or perhaps have grown up around some false theme. brought in from somewhere else. And I think people regard Albuquerque as a really authentic Western city with its own character and a good brand and a place, you know, you run into someone in a bar at an airport and they say, where are you from? And you say Albuquerque and they say, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, that's a neat place. So I think it's a place that generates a mental image that causes people to want to be there. One thing you notice in Albuquerque and locals complain bitterly about are the amount of homeless people walking around. And there's no easy quick fix for that, although I want to talk about one. But the main observation that I and other people have made walking around Albuquerque is that the reason why there's so many homeless people walking around is because there's no other people walking around. So, like, most cities, it isn't that Albuquerque has more homeless than most cities, it's that Albuquerque has so many fewer pedestrians who aren't homeless than most cities, that the chances are, if you're walking around, it's going to be a homeless person that you bump into. But that perception, I think, would be quickly, reduced if we could just get more people walking who aren't homeless. Now, secondarily, and I have not, I'm not a homelessness expert, and I haven't been involved in the homelessness discussion in Albuquerque at all, but I did talk in my report briefly, and I would like to stress here, that there's been a revolution in thinking in how to deal with homelessness in the past a few years, and I believe it's Salt Lake City who's had the greatest success here. Simply providing housing with no questions asked to the homeless in Salt Lake City save them about half the money they were spending. So I'm not sure what the policy is in Albuquerque. I don't know. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn because this is already underway. But I do think that that's something that we need to pursue also, because a lot of people see that as an impediment to their walking downtown.
Well, Jeff, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I would like to thank Jeff Speck, my guest today. Thanks also to my producer, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Chebecki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of all my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.